You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host, and we're here on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be talking about Craft Malt Week and all more about this wonderful world of craft beer. And Mr. Brent, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, hey, I'm Brent Manning. I am co-founder of Riverbend Malt House in Asheville, North Carolina, and also one of the co-founders of the North American Craft Maltsters Guild.
All right. So for our listeners, going back about a year and a half ago, I got connected through some folk with the Craft Maltsters Guild, and we've done some pretty in-depth shows about craft malt, more than we ever have in the last year and a half. And we have talked to Brent before. So it's a special opportunity to talk to him. Craft Malt Week is coming up in September 11th to 17th, and Brent's going through some expansion. So we're going to have a one-on-one talk with this champion and pioneer of craft malt. So Brent, for our listeners, you know, just to refresh everyone, how'd you get started in craft malt?
So the story goes back. Myself and co-founder Brian Simpson, we used to be environmental consultants on the coast of North Carolina in the early 2000s. And when the housing market collapsed, we quickly found ourselves kind of looking for encore careers. And we were both really into the outdoors and wanted to move our families up to Asheville. And, you know, quickly just discovered, oh, man, we're going to have to reinvent ourselves here professionally. And I was a homebrew, loved craft beer. But, you know, at the time we thought Asheville had enough breweries. So we started looking into the supply chain piece because we're sustainability geeks. We had done biodiesel together and just really started looking at that. Hops didn't work for a variety of reasons. We didn't own any land for starters. And then when we started talking about small grains, the conversation got a lot more interesting because of the amount of existing acreage and infrastructure and research available to us in the Southeast. So we started working with Ag Extension, found some growers that wanted to grow some barley with us, and we planted our first crop under contract back in 2010 and made our first batch of malt in early 2011 or late 2011, a whopping 1,800 pound batch. So, wow. And been growing steadily since.
Did you think at that time, did you feel that you said that you thought North Carolina was ripe for it? Do you feel like that the conditions in North Carolina were ahead of other parts of the country?
I don't know if it was that or what felt right was the sourcing piece of it. This is, you know, connecting the farmer to the craft beer movement. And we knew that, like, you know, there was so much focus on local food in Western North Carolina and all of that connective tissue and interest and energy around it. We thought, how perfect. Let's just find barley grown in this region and we'll put that into this craft beer that everyone's going crazy for. And, you know, this is before Sierra Nevada, New Belgium, Oscar Blues, you know, announced their East Coast expansions. This was really even before the South Slope and downtown was a thing. I mean, this was, you know, early days in Asheville, but there was still this just really exciting energy in the space. And we thought, this was the way to enhance that.
You sure did. So back to the sourcing and the farmer. I mean, often you think about, I remember Pete Brown was talking about, I think it was Miracle Brews, he was talking about the ingredients. And for years, I think a lot of people would think that beer was made of chemicals. And we know it's not. But even when you think about craft malt, you think about shopping, you think about dialing up a chocolate malt or a specialty malt. But I want to hear about one or two early relationships with a farmer or farming family that really made a difference for you, and maybe some of the trials and tribulations when you were getting started. Because I'm sure, how could they believe in you? I mean, there weren't that many people asking for, you know, malt quality barley then, were they?
No. I mean, I visited many a farm in the early days where, you know, a farmer would point to a pile of feed barley dumped in the corner of a barn and just say, you know, how's that look to you? And I said, not great. That's not what I'm looking for. And, you know, so there were a lot of, you know, conversations about quality and you know, cleaning, storage, etc. A lot of heartburn moments there. You know, but a couple of stories that come to mind. You know, we started out so green, figuratively and literally. You know, everything was organic and everything, you know, was so close to home. And then early on in 2000 or 2012, I think, we had a really just terrible crop year, and the organic barley was just awful. And a man by the name of Billy Dawson came to see us, and he said, guys, I know you're organic, but take a look at this conventionally grown thoroughbred six-row barley that came off my farm. And it was just gleaming, golden, perfect, beautiful barley. And we're like, all right, well, if it's the choice of closing up shop or working with Billy Dawson, we're going to go down this road with Billy and see what happens. And, you know, that really beautiful barley also helped us make better malt. And that was a huge moment for us that we were like, okay, specs just improved. And this is right about the time that, you know, the mixed culture movement in the craft beer space was starting to percolate, and people were sort of looking for that sort of rustic malt that was a taste of place to augment their, you know, spontaneous projects and all of that. And here comes Riverbend with a locally sourced six-row Pilsner malt. And it was just perfect timing. And things just went up from there.
Well, what was one of the first beers of note that was made with your malt?
You know, let's see. That was a long time ago. Yeah. So, I mean, there are early days, like, you know, I think one of the earliest one was just called Riverbend Brown with Pisgah Brewing Company in Black Mountain. And then Ariel had a rye IPA with our malted rye that was, you know, back when they were on like a 1.5 barrel system in the early, early days. You know, they'd call us and, you know, we'd mill like partial bags for them and stuff like that. It was pretty crazy back in those, you know, early days. We kind of envisioned ourselves like the milkman, you know, except with malt, you know, that we would just load up the truck and make deliveries out to the breweries in town and come back and rake the malt or clean a batch or start a kiln run or something. And we weren't far off in those early days, honestly. I mean, it was just trying to figure things out.
Oh, yeah. And what's amazing how it's changed. I was thinking of a list of, you know, the maltsters that I know and certain breweries that work with them. And I know you're going to tell me about a beer that you're drinking, but I want to go through some of the Northeast ones I know. Like, a big surprise, which it wasn't a surprise, but just from the time I've known craft malt is about 8 years. And Industrial Arts with Jeff O'Neill, as they've grown, they do some specific series with locally grown ingredients. And I feel like I think I'm going to talk about how it's craft malt has grown and the fact that the craft malt week is coming up in September. Just to see like a great brewer like Jeff O'Neill at Industrial Arts and have dedicated lines of beer that showcase local ingredients. Are you seeing that across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think what's been really fun to see is, you know, we try to pull brewers out of a plug and play mindset and get them to kind of start with the malt the flavor profiles that they pick up from the hot steep assessments, you know, kind of get, instead of like taking a flagship beer and taking out a major component that's driving that flavor profile and replacing it with something different, you know, it might be a win, it might not. And so, you know, for us, at least speaking for Riverbend, you know, we try to invite customers to kind of, you know, crawl before they walk and make a seasonal or a one-off. And then as they settle in with it, then we can talk about migrating into a flagship. And I think from coast to coast, we're seeing folks. I mean, you know, I know our friends at Admiral out in Alameda, you know, their Pilsner malt has done phenomenal things. That I think is it Trimmer Brewing or there's a Pilsner that's just absolutely crushed it with their malt that's won at GABF and World Beer Cup in the last 18 months. And so, you know, getting some recognition like that, you know, seeing Rabbit Hill in New Jersey work with the Seed project there and the recognition that those folks have gotten. We've got a great list here with folks like we've got, you know, Fauna Flora and, you know, pretty much everybody in the South Slope is doing some pretty amazing things on, you know, not only just mixed culture, but we're going into lagers. We're finding homes in IPAs now. So it's that's been really fun to see that, you know, is when we can play in the specialty one-offs, but then when we can also get the green light because of our consistency to make it into an IPA that's on the grocery store shelves, you know, there's a different kind of pride that comes with that, you know?
Oh yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the evolution from being a specialty or a one-off malt to being, what do you call it? You want to be the primary, it's called primary malt.
Or, you know, get it. What we would refer to as being your, you know, your base malt contract or something like that. You know, as beer brewing and styles have evolved, you know, once upon a time, you know, an IPA had pale malt in it, and now a lot of folks use, you know, can oscillate. It could be a Pilsner malt from Canada. It could be Golden Promise from over in the UK. There's almost no crystal malt in the modern IPA recipe. So, you know, expectations have really shifted around a fair bit in the last 10 years in terms of what brewers are looking for when they think about the grist of an IPA that, you know, dominates 50 to 60% of sales right now. So, but to answer your question, you know, as we're going along, you know, I think it's exciting to be recognized early as developing and creating beautiful, unique flavors, but then also to be recognized for making something that's beautiful and unique so consistently that you can deliver large volumes of it into an IPA recipe that is, you know, kind of the turn and burn recipe for a given brewery in our area. So I think, cause that's kind of that's just a different step, you know, being recognized as delivering beautiful, flavorful malt at capacity in a consistent fashion is super challenging to get to. I mean, it's no joke to turn over batch after batch of, you know, malt that arrives within a half an SRM in a color spec and, you know, consistently above 81% extract, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't happen by accident.
And are you guys now are celebrating your 10th harvest?
11th as of 22. Now. So So pretty wild. Yeah, and our growers are a big piece of that consistency. You know, early on, we would get, you know, lots from different growers, and the quality would vary sometimes tremendously across the state, across the region. And now, as our growers have gotten more experience, the quality is just uniformly better. And so better raw materials makes better finished malt. I mean, it's just that simple.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great talking to you about this. And we'll get a little more specific. So we talk a little bit about farms. I want to talk about equipment.
Sure.
Because it all seems, you know, you think of the old days, there's like a little oven and you know, you're toasting some malt. You know, maybe someone's burning the old barrel staves. And that's flavoring the malt. You're expanding now, and it sounds like you kind of outlined just how you've grown with the industry around you. But what's the new fancy equipment that you got? I can't even pronounce it.
So to paint a picture for our listeners, so our first kiln was constructed out of insulated aluminum panels, and it was skinned with a fireproof foam board, and we daisy chained electric heating elements together to one single thermostat and one single blower. And it had absolutely no instrumentation. One of us would have to go in the middle of the night and make damper changes as we went through free dry, force dry, and curing during the kilning stage. And then, you know, flash forward to today, where we're welcoming our fourth 10-ton GKV or germ kiln vessel into the building. And, you know, this thing stands 20 plus feet tall and is so full of instrumentation that we get a full readout every couple of seconds that we can check in on it with our smartphones. And it's just been really fascinating to, see this evolution. I always sort of playfully pick on our brewer customers. I said, you know, if you guys want to open a brewery, you just put the word out at a place like CBC and you could have half a dozen engineers show up on your door and help you lay out the space for maximum efficiency and all of that. And, you know, craft malt just didn't have that at all. I mean, it was either you were in the market for something that was like a research size, like chest freezer. Like they called it a Joe White maltings. It was like a test malting thing that would do 500 grams of a bunch of different samples in a uniform fashion. Obviously 500 grams doesn't do much for us if we're trying to make commercial scale batches of beer. So you were either at the Joe White malting scale or you were at something like, you know, it starting at 50 to 100 tons, and there was nothing in between. So that's why you see a lot of the early craft maltsters were, you know, truly DIYing kiln design using an old textbook called Malt and Malting that had some basic engineering information in it regarding airflow and BTUs and such for heat. And, it's been really wild to see that evolution. Much like craft beer, craft malt brings people in from a lot of different backgrounds and skill sets. And so it's super fun just to see how people's skills, you know, turn into innovation.
You know, when we hear about craft malt, there's that image of the floor malting and the hardworking person raking the malt. What's the technology of that? And how far away is that from your new machine?
So the technology, and we still floor malt too. I mean, that's baked into our DNA. We're not going to turn that loose. But, you know, the technology of that, I would say, is really more in sort of the human hand and the human sensory experience. I mean, that's really what we zero in on is, you know, we use our floor malt system as a way of teaching and developing new products. So if we have new employees, getting them in there to sort of see, taste, smell, and explore the grain during that crucial germination stage, you know, that is far more impactful than having them open the, a manway on a 10-ton GKV, you know, where it's just looks and feels a little bit more industrial. A lot of the same processes are going on, but it's not quite as intimate, you know? And so having that floor malt experience allows, you know, us to play around with new barley varieties and new crops and make small mistakes And then also serves as a great training tool to bring our staff up to speed on what healthy germinating barley looks and smells like at each of those crucial stages. So I guess that's really, if it makes any sense to call it human technology, but that's really how we see it.
No, that's neat. I mean, it's just, like I said, it's hard to understand that yeah, there's farmers and then there's processes, but there's something that goes on that you guys are doing right. So
yeah,
I want to call it magic. I like the old days, you would have called it magic.
I want to call it magic too, you know, and it's, you know, and a lot of it too, you know, knowing those smells and those tastes and, you know, doing the, you know, thumb and forefinger test of rubbing out the endosperm and the germinating grain and understanding that at that sort of small scale 2-ton level has helped us fine tune the larger batches to get very similar flavor profiles out of the bigger batches. And that really, I think it has been super cool. And we even work with the engineers to kind of allow the big difference when we talk about floor malting versus pneumatic malting, which is what's happening in the GKBs, is really the rise and fall of temperature and humidity in the grain bed during germination. So in floor malt, kind of imagine it like a sinusoidal wave. You know, it builds up as the grain is germinating, and then you get to that 8-hour point, and the rake comes through, the rootlets break up, the air exchange occurs, the cool air enters, and everything kind of cools down for a little bit. And then all that enzymatic digestive work starts generating heat again, and the process repeats itself over 3 to 5 days. And so, you know, taking a little bit of that sort of flow and mapping that into our germination program is, you know, really fun to be able to play with those dynamics and try to match up flavors that way.
Wow. Yeah, it's something to talk more about, and, you know, and in depth. Right now I'm just trying to get my head around it. And it'd be great to taste a couple of beers, you know, this to the same barley with floor malt versus I'm sure you do these tests, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We've only had one customer tell us they can tell the difference between the two products. So, you know, because, you know, most all of our current flagship products began life as 2-ton batches, and we fine tuned the blending and the timing and the temperatures on the floor, and then map that over to the 10 ton and made sure, and we did the side-by-side tastings of the finished malt to make sure we were flavor matching at the larger scale.
Wow, man. You know, and now you have a role in the Craft Maltsters Guild. Tell us a little bit about the Craft Malt Week, because they have the Craft Malt Conference, which I've sat in on the last 2 years, and now it's Craft Malt Week.
Yeah, so we're really looking forward to this September. It'll be our third Craft Malt Week. You know, it, as is often the case, it began as a day and then spilled over into a week-long celebration. And it was really conceived as an opportunity for storytelling and to let people sort of peek behind the curtain and see what is going on in this industry, because it's – I always tell people, it's like, how far back do you want me to start the story? Do you want me to start when the barley variety began its development 10 years ago? Or do you want me to start when it was planted in October? Or do you want me to just start when we received it in late summer? You know, it's like, so sort of peeling back all those layers and letting people see how much effort goes into making really special locally crafted products and the resulting beautiful lagers and ales that our brewers put together, you know, I think enhances people's appreciation. You know, it's easy to get lost in craft beer when you're drinking a fruited sour that's, you know, 20% blackberries and boysenberry puree and whatever. But you know, if you're drinking a beautifully crafted Helles, you know, that's a little bit easier to draw a tight line of sight between the malt and the story behind all of that.
Oh yeah. You know, in the last year I've gotten to know more of the Craft Maltsters. We did talk with Admiral this year. But in the Northeast, it's I'm still stuck on like Kent Falls in Connecticut and the work they do with Valley Malt. And, you know, Plan B in the Hudson Valley always works with this really small farmhouse malt and also Hudson Valley malt. But one that stands out is the OEC, which is in Connecticut also. And they use a lot of traditional processes as a brewer, but they work with one farm called Thrall Family Farm for their wheat. And I'm trying to get to the wheat thing. And they're making like a 19th century style wheat. There's a couple of versions. And whenever I see it, I grab it. You know, we always talk about barley. I don't know what it is. I just know on the can it always says Thrall Family Farms. And I'm pretty sure it's the wheat. So they're often the wheat beer is using their wheat. But for you guys, you know, what role do the other grains play? You know, we know that barley, the challenge was barley, getting the right varieties of barley to grow, especially in the Northeast, you know, and just learning how to malt properly and all that.
Sure. Yeah. You know, our first challenge was we only had six row barley. So thinner kernels, typically, you know, six row malt was typically associated with macro lagers and craft brewers did not want anything to do with it. So that was one big challenge. And then, you know, as we explored some of the other grains that are available, you know, it was exciting challenges all around, you know, working with our Abruzzi rye. You know, everyone always complains about working with rye. It's a pain to malt. It doesn't have a husk and it's just oilier. It can mash down when you're walking on it, raking it. It just creates a lot of extra headaches along the way. But the flavor is just out of this world. You know, it's just lots of interesting floral notes, you know, black peppercorn just really pops when you compare it with some of the more modern hybrids that are hitting the market right now. You know, so, but for us, you know, we've done some heirloom wheat. We've settled in on a couple of more recently released soft red winter wheats that, you know, perform beautifully. I mean, we always keep an open line of communication with local bakers. And we like to learn what varieties they're into working with. And then kind of we always figure if the bakers are happy, the brewers will be too. And that's largely been the case. And, you know, then exciting things like the challenge of the hazy IPA craze, you know, how to, you know, as we saw that rising in popularity, we were like, well, I guess we got to figure out how to malt oats and where do those come from? And, you know, are they a pain in the butt? And how do we figure out the eccentricities of that? And, you know, we've also continued to explore the space of malting corn, which, you know, corn is a summer crop. So corn likes warmer water when it goes into germination, and it behaves a little differently during germination. Typically takes longer to hit the same level of modification that, say, a modern barley variety would. So, you know, that creates some process scheduling challenges, and it's but it's something we're starting to get known for, you know, as we can make large amounts of malted corn. It's uniform and readily available. So, you know, that's opening doors in both the brewing and distilling spaces for us. So that's been a fun one.
Oh, that's great, man. Hey, we're off to a great start. We're going to be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Support us and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. And over 30 podcasts every week. And engineers like Armin Spingen, who's working with us, and several others are on all these podcasts, giving you great audio quality. And the nonprofit, heritageradionetwork.org. So, Brett, great conversation. So we brought up corn, and I was just thinking, I wonder what beers you have in corn. But, of course, you mentioned spirits.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's been, you've probably seen the statistics. Rye whiskey is growing, triple digits year over year. Whether you're big bourbon or craft distilleries, everyone's enjoying this new resurgence of different spirits, and it's really exciting to play a role in that. You may have seen that they finally sort of standardized the American single malt whiskey category definition now, and I think that's just one more exciting chapter of what's going to happen for craft malt as an industry. It's a little limiting to me in the sense that it has to be all barley, but because there's, as we just talked about, there's so many other fun grains that can be explored in the space. But I get it. You need to define it.
So American single malt has to be all barley.
Correct. All malted barley.
All malted barley.
And And so, but again, obviously we can do a lot with different specialty development. There's nothing that says they can't blend a pale ale and a dark Munich or a Vienna and a Pilsner or whatever. So plenty of space for innovation on that front. And, the American consumer is showing plenty of interest in the premium category. So that also opens up a lot of room to explore as well with, longer aging and barrel finishes and other fun stuff like that.
Yeah. You want to give a shout out to a distiller that's using one of your malts?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We've got our buddies here in town, Oak and Grist, have been making an American malt whiskey with our product pretty much since they swung the doors open. And they also make an all malt gin with our products as well, and it's really fun to see those releases just continue to flourish and people get more excited about what they're doing. ASW down in Atlanta is got some fun stuff waiting in the wings. Chattanooga Whiskey as well, we've got some fun stuff. Look for them. They're going to have a steady cadence of special request malt-based products coming out in the months and years ahead. So pretty pumped about them.
You said Chattanooga Whiskey?
Chattanooga Whiskey, yeah, man.
All right.
Yeah, we usually get a call from them once or twice a year, and it's, the guy, head guy Grant will be like, "You ever malted triticale?" And we'll be like, no, but we can try it. You ever smoked any malt with a barrel or barrel chunks? Yeah, sure, we got you, man. It's the spirit space has been really cool to watch it evolve, and the growth is a really eye-popping to see what's happening, both from legacy distilleries as well as those in the craft space.
Yeah. Hey, you use the word convert in a couple of stories about folks converting to using craft malt. I know you mentioned the beer you're drinking. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this is a really beautiful Pilsner called Pull Tab Pilsner from our friends at Mason Jar Lager Company down in Fuquay Varina, North Carolina, central part of the state. These guys were doing lagers long before the before it was cool, I guess you could say. And they're a convert in the sense that they were very traditional in their sourcing. You know, if it was a German style Pilsner, it was going to use German malt. And in the wake of some of these supply chain issues that we're all wading through right now, we started having some in-depth conversations about, what would that look like if we, displaced an international product and went local. How would that be a dramatic departure in flavor? Would they lose efficiency? What would they be giving up if in exchange for that convenience of a local supplier? And I'm really happy to report that they didn't have to give up anything. They actually saw process improvements. Brew day got faster and easier. Efficiency levels even rose a bit, and they were over the moon with the flavor of the finished beer. They felt like we stepped in and improved their process and their finished beer. And, that's just been a beautiful thing there to sort of shine a light on both parties through that experience of that we can step in and compete and win against a longstanding international supplier. And that's been very gratifying for us at Riverbend.
In terms of just other grains, I'm meeting small farmers in the Northeast who are just starting to mill, heirloom corn for polenta, and they put the mill date on the package when I get it. How important with malted barley, how important is the date it was malted and packed? Is that different than just milling, like I said, corn for porridge?
Yeah, absolutely. Freshness totally matters. In the current state of play, what we're hearing is it's about a 3-month transit time across the Atlantic and, potentially another month getting through customs and getting, from the port to the brewery itself and all of that. On the flip side, we're shipping malt that's probably 2 to 3 weeks old, next day after we receive an order. And so that, we're shaving months off of the time, and we get comments all the time from breweries just like, oh my God, we brewed today and it smelled like a bakery in my brew house. And all of the staff was asking like, what are y'all doing today? Cause it smells so different, so much fresher. So always good to see that. And, to see that translate to the freshly packaged beer, just super gratifying and cool to see that everybody all the way to the bartender is recognizing what's happening.
Well, for years I've had customers asking about, more malt forward beers. But now, like I said, when I'm drinking craft malt beers that are not too hoppy, more of a traditional style, I'm loving it. My palate's changed a lot.
Yeah. It's been real fun. The other probably, and I wish I could have shared this experience with a larger audience, but as we've been playing around and growing our single origin Pilsner program, at one point, one of our customers downtown, Dissolver, had 4 different lagers made with 4 different barley varieties. And to be able to put those side by side and talk with Vince, the head of operations and brewing there, and really nerd out, about what was he liking about the Hirandella versus the Violetta. And, the minute I tasted, we did a project with Skagit Valley, where we swapped barley varieties. And, he just, the minute he tasted the malt, he was like, it's going to be perfect in this style lager. And, those types of things, like when we really do get down to the brass tacks of like, those individual nuances of flavor. Like I say, I'm not ready to talk that we're ready to claim terroir, that we can grow the same barley variety on, you know, the east side of the hill versus the west side of the hill and it tastes different. But I'm definitely in full-throated support that barley varieties definitely make different flavor profiles in finished malt.
I've got a couple of notes I'm supposed to ask you on that line. 2022 harvest with Avalon barley and Virginia Tech.
Yes. Oh, I love this story. So, you know, I mentioned Ag Extension earlier, you know, both in North Carolina State and also at Virginia Tech, both have public plant breeding programs that deliver newly developed barley and wheat varieties to the public. And these programs are necessary for, you know, continuing yield improvement, disease resistance, and a whole host of other factors. Early on, when River Bend was just getting going, we sat down with the head of the small grains program at Virginia Tech, a gentleman named Carl Griffey, and his right-hand man, Wincy Brooks. And, you know, it was a wonderful meeting. You know, we're so tiny, you know, making like maybe 100,000 pounds of malt at the time. But, you know, they said, well, what are you looking for from a variety? And I said, well, first off, please bring us a two row as soon as you can. And then secondly, we said, you know, there's no number for flavor, but we'd love to have something that, you know, really sort of stands out from the crowd, like the hallowed ground of Golden Promise or Maris Otter or something like that. And, you know, and they said, well, great. Okay, cool. And I presented the craft. This is probably 2012, 2013. I presented all the beautiful data of them, of the craft brewing industry growing double digits year over year. And, you know, and they're like, okay, well, I think we can help you with this, guys. And I said, you know, great. How long till we can have a variety? And they're like, it'll probably take 8 to 10 years. And I was like, wait, what? I just told you this industry is exploding and the Southeast is like got the most room for growth of any region in the US. And they're just like, look at me like, this is our process. You know, it just takes time to build a variety that checks all those boxes that you just mentioned. And so anyway, flash forward, I'm standing in the field with Wincy Brooks in, you know, May at a field day event out on the coast of Virginia. And there we stand, you know, with a beautiful research plot of Avalon barley that, you know, nice plump kernels and everything's looking beautiful. And, you know, we talk a lot about test weight as a general marker of quality. So a bushel of barley should weigh about 48 pounds. If it weighs 50 pounds, it's really, really superior quality barley. And so that was one thing they keyed in on during their development of this variety, is really driving on test weight, disease resistance, all sorts of stuff. Along the way, we got to do some trial maltings. When they narrowed it down to about half a dozen varieties, we got to do a trial malting on each of those and presented them with some flavor data. And it was really great because two of the final four had fantastic flavor and just malted very easily. And, you know, they selected this variety and named it Avalon. and to follow, just to follow that thread through. So you're standing on maybe a 10 by 50 foot variety plot in their variety trials. And the next step is what they call breeder seed. They make the plots a little bigger. And then they take it to a certified seed program to scale it up for commercial production. So even when it left the research world, we still had another couple of years for it to get commercial levels of seed. So this year will be an early access point for us. Maybe we'll get a couple of truckloads, something like that. And then our hope is, you know, it'll be commercial scale availability at the 2023 harvest. But very excited about this variety. Climate change is happening, and this variety has weathered a pretty wild decade of extreme rain, drought, all sorts of different climatic stressors during these trials. So we're optimistic that this barley can lead us deep into the next decade.
Wow, that's great. Hey, talking about the Craft Malt Week that's coming up, September 11th to 17th, sure. You know, you talk about converts to craft malt. So are you kind of a proselytizer? I know that there's a story you guys posted on Instagram. There's a farming couple in the Netherlands that met you at one of the conferences. You want to tell us about them? Because I love that story.
So do I. I always love when those stories come back around, because, you know, I just feel like, you know, especially at the conferences and things like that, I just roll out of bed and just start talking about craft malt to anybody who's within 10 feet of me. And, you know, these folks, it was really exciting to see them, you know, join the guild, learn, you know, actually take advantage of the educational resources that we provide our members, and then translate that education to action and actually start producing beautiful craft malt from barley grown on their farm. And it was cool. I actually went to their Instagram feed and looked at this beautiful little contraption that they built to turn the floor malt. And I was immediately like, well, I want one of those. Like, that looks super cool. And then I go through some more, and they have like this beautiful little like miniature, what would I call it? Like a skid steer kind of a thing that scoops the barley up off the floor without shovels. And I'm like, damn it, they figured it out. Like, this little contraption is way more efficient than having two or three people shoveling malt off the floor, you know? They did it. So I love that kind of thing, you know, where, you know, we give them a little, give folks, you know, that are enterprising entrepreneurs, you give them a little, fan that flame just a little bit, and then you turn around in a couple of years and they built a better mousetrap, you know. It's awesome.
Oh, that's great. That's a great story. I'm going to ask a serious question because, you know, I see how these industries evolve. I think when early days of talking about whether it was barley or hops, I know in New York there was like crop insurance. Well, now that you're growing, who is funding craft malt, and when did it become fundable? That's my question.
You mean from an investor standpoint?
Investor, bank, credit. I mean, you know, trust of your, others in your industry.
Yeah, you know, I think where craft malt really has found a home is, you know, as people are looking for environmentally conscious businesses to support, we fit in really beautifully because it's such a clear storyline of, you know, let's put air quotes around fixing a problem of moving grain from one side of the country or one side of the world to a brewery that's nested in a given investor's backyard. And now all of a sudden you're saying that one of the key ingredients in that beer can also come from their backyard. And they, that story is really resonating right now as is it as sexy as, you know, some sort of financial technology software that can be replicated and spun up into a 1,000% year over year growth? It's tough to compete with that. You know, we're still, you know, I always tell people whenever we talk to potential investors, it's like, let me be very clear. We do not make widgets here. This is an agricultural product, and beer is an agricultural product. And we can do everything right, and Mother Nature can still throw us a curveball. But here's what we've done to mitigate risk across a lot of different channels to make sure that we always have a steady pipeline of raw materials that are high quality, you know? So I think it's really that sort of environmentally conscious, sustainability focused investor group that's growing steadily, that's is supportive of this industry.
Thank you. That's a great answer. A couple more questions. When we first were talking before the show, you mentioned supply chain and opportunities. Yeah. So we hear about, you know, there's wars, there's grain supplies being disrupted, you know, transportation issues. So what is the supply chain opportunity and what do you want to say about it?
As I mentioned, when you and I were chatting before we started recording, you know, I think a lot of our customers kind of looked at me like I was full of it when I would talk about like, oh, well, you know, we offer an alternative to, you know, any sort of supply chain hiccups and stuff like that. And they would always kind of be like, what supply chain hiccups? I put in my order with the big suppliers and it arrives in a couple of days and we're all good. And, you know, that's fine. That's when the system was working perfectly. But now that we have, you know, right now, global commodities, including grain and everything else, is stuck in shipping containers, moving in different loops and directions at triple the cost that it was 3 to 4 years ago. And there's some geopolitical things that are changing, you know, who's growing grain and who's buying it and all of that. All of that is tied up and creates heartburn for small scale breweries. And, you know, enter Craft Malt, who by definition is regionally sourcing and regionally shipping, in some cases handling shipping in-house with their own box truck or flatbed or whatever. And all of a sudden that heartburn goes away when you can call. I mean, I have customers that call and text daily and they're just like, it's a 10-word text. Hey, Brent, can I have a pallet of Southern Select? I say, I've got you covered. The wheels are in motion. It'll be there Thursday. And that's the sum total of their experience, you know. And that, I think, is, unfortunately, it took a transportation meltdown occurring over months and months, coupled with some pretty low quality material being harvested out of Europe and Western US in 2021. All those converging factors really opened up a lot of people's eyes to what the value of going local means.
Well, that's a great one, man. Thank you. I feel better about the world already. I know. It's the same for me with food and everything. You know, it's like, I want an egg that's from nearby, and it's always hard to translate it to, you know, to use it in a restaurant or commercial operation. But more and more, we're seeing all those networks rise up. Last one about going back to farmers, and the last question I'm supposed to ask you, because it is important. You got, your slogan is Malt with a Mission. What is that, and how does that relate to local farms?
Yeah, so it started off, you know, again, it was just making that connection to, you know, we saw at the time, craft beer in North Carolina was on pace to be a $1 billion industry every year. And when we really looked at how the industry was structured, the farmer was completely shut out of that industry because of the lack of infrastructure between the field and the fermenter. And so Malt with a Mission was born with the goal of connecting those two dots. And, you know, it meant figuring out, you know, talking to Ag Extension about the best way to grow grain, finding seed cleaners and trucking companies that could take care of the grain and get it to us in good condition. And then us learning how to make world-class malt over the last decade to really be that final step on the way to the brew house. And it's, you know, it's been great. We've connected with farmers. In most cases, we're a second, if not a third paycheck for them because we're buying winter grain. So we're not competing with the traditional corn and soybeans that grow in the summer. You know, you get some environmental benefits from doing the cover cropping that comes with an off-season crop. And, you know, we're just really proud to have helped growers connect with. I mean, now craft beer is a $1 billion industry just in Western North Carolina alone. I mean, and close to $2 billion, I think, across the state. So, and that's just North Carolina. That's not even talking about Tennessee, Virginia, and the rest of the Florida has been huge for us as well. So it's just been crazy to make these connections across the Southeast.
Wow, Brent, this is a great talking to you one-on-one, a real treat for me. And thanks to your team for setting it up.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Just thank you, Brent. And thanks to our team, Armin Spengen, engineer, and Alex Tran, producing intern. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo, thank you.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast.